Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
57 minutes into the movie, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. The action is picking up, so lots to talk about. But Hal, why don't you catch us up on what's going on in that little airplane up in the sky?
All right, minute 57. Aboard the Silver Beach 18, slicing through the night sky over the Italian Alps, Howard Stark grips the controls, his voice steady. "We should be able to drop you right on the doorstep." Steve Rogers, clad in his Captain America gear, adjusts his parachute. "Just get me as close as you can. You two are going to be in a lot of trouble when you land." Peggy Carter raises an eyebrow. "And you won't." "Where I'm going, if anybody yells at me, I can just shoot him," Steve quips, checking his shield. "They will undoubtedly shoot back," Peggy retorts. "Well, let's hope it's good for something," Steve says, patting his shield. Howard glances back, a smirk on his face. "Agent Carter, if we're not in too much of a hurry, I thought we could stop off in Lucerne for a late-night fondue." Peggy ignores him, focusing on Steve. "Stark is the best civilian pilot I've ever seen. He's mad enough to brave this airspace. We're lucky to have him." Steve hesitates, glancing between them. "So are you two... do you fondue?" Peggy, unfazed, hands him a device. "This is your transponder. Activate it when you're ready, and the signal will lead us straight to you." Steve eyes the gadget. "Are you sure this thing works?" "It's been tested more than you, pal," Howard replies, grinning. Flak bursts outside, rocking the airplane. Steve moves to the open rear door, wind whipping past. Peggy shouts, "Get back here. We're taking you all the way in." More flak explodes, closer now. Steve grips the door frame. "As soon as I'm clear, you turn this thing around and get the hell out of here." Peggy leans forward, her voice sharp. "You can't." And break.
Hanger.
Yes. Wow. Well, this is quite a minute, but for what we were talking about beforehand, Brian, you have a lot of very heavily slanted opinions about fondue.
Very controversial. First of all, Steve is such a rube in this minute. I know it's the 40s, but still, never heard of fondue. But now I have made, for a long time, fondue was my family's New Year's Eve tradition. We would make a big pot of fondue, usually cheese, but also sometimes cheese and chocolate if we had two fondue pots available. And that was what we'd eat on New Year's Eve. So I've made a lot of fondue. I'm very fond of fondue. It's got to have the Gruyere. It's Swiss recommended. But the secret, and I learned this from a professional fondue chef in a fondue restaurant, yes, such things exist, is you need about a tablespoon of cornstarch in there, because that's what keeps your cheese sauce from breaking. And once your cheese sauce breaks, you might as well just throw it out. You can't recover a broken cheese sauce. But just a little bit of cornstarch, it's a little thick, a little thickness, a little body, holds it together. And we were debating. We said, save it for the show. I love fondue. Fondue is one of my favorite things. Classic French bread or sourdough French bread, lightly toasted in the oven. Can't beat it.
I do have a, I used to work in a, I guess you call it upper, you know, an upper level restaurant, and we didn't serve fondue, but we did have Gruyere for our French onion soup.
Yes. Yeah, that's the traditional.
The only way I can describe the scent of Gruyere to me is vomitorious. I just, the smell of Gruyere just makes my stomach churn. And having
so
to,
you're the man with the controversial opinions.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Having to ladle it over a pot of hot onion soup nightly, just, I'm dead. I'm not a Gruyere man. If made it with any other, maybe any of the British cheeses.
But you need the tang of the Gruyere. You really do, I think.
Well, yeah, it's tricky. I'd like to try a mix of something. I think several cheeses might help.
But have you heard of Velveeta?
Yes.
That may be more your speed, Jim.
And get some and of that Jim, powdered craft stuff.
Yeah, Jim, there are a lot of aerosol can-based cheeses that are just as tasty as the real thing.
Fondue whiz, I can see it now.
And they're already, you know, they're already the right consistency. And
right on by the only one that's got Gruyere in it. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
Dang, exactly. Right on my Ritz cracker, yeah.
It's Gruyere whiz. I don't, if it exists, I want to try it, and I dearly hope it does not.
I'm a huge fondue fan.
Yeah. No, from what I understand, there is a controversy between egg or not egg in fondue. You're supposed to, true Swiss fondue cheese will have egg mixed in with it, cheese, wine, and eggs mixed into the blend as you, that's the traditional Swiss.
Just another thickening agent?
Yeah, I would think, well, I mean, you're trying, with cheese, you're trying to keep the proteins and the fat connected.
Exactly.
And if you don't have that, as Brian was talking about, the emulsifier of holding the protein and oil together, it's going to, the lipids are going to separate, and then you just got to, in short, you've got a ghastly mess. So
I like my fondue like I like my beer. It should just have a very small number of simple ingredients combined in the right way. And
no corn.
I'm not putting egg in my fondue.
So, Brian, I have a question, and this may be too personal, but I'm curious about this. So when you say you make it, it's a family thing. And so you've got a fondue pot. Now, is there a ladle, and are people sort of taking a scoop and putting it in like their own little receptacle and then dipping in it? Or as a family, do we just all walk up and dip? And if so, do we double dip?
It is horrifically unhygienic. We might as well be just eating it out of each other's mouths like birds. No, it's awful. It's awful. You got the forks and you dip your bread in the cheese. And sometimes, the cheese, the bread falls off, and then you got to kiss the cook. And my only hope in all these years has been that the heat sterilizes everything. And it's not that hot. I don't think it could, but...
It's a safe assumption.
Yeah.
And again, just a matter of curiosity, having never done that in the family setting, are we only dipping? Sorry, Jim. Are we only dipping bread? Are there meats? Are there or?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of fondue, and I did not come prepared to speak about this, but you could get your chocolate fondue. You can use fruit, angel food cake, any kind of cake or fruity kind of stuff, like strawberries, of course, is classic, but you can go little orange slices or anything. And then there are the meat fondues, and you can heat up like a beef broth or even oil in the pan, get an oil nice and hot, and get a beef broth nice and hot, cook the meat in that liquid.
It's like a bourguignon, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, three or four minutes in there, and you got yourself a nice rare piece of steak ready to have. And, so there's all fondue is just wonderful. It's a very versatile method of food preparation and enjoyment. Very communal, perhaps too communal. But it's always just been great fun for me. And I think it's because I have those, family holiday associations with it.
Wow. So if Jim ever joins your family, say for New Year's Eve, he'll just be at the kids' table with a Happy Meal and,
and Lunchables.
A can of cheese whiz.
And a can of cheese whiz. Yeah, Lunchables and cheese whiz.
Straight, aim straight in your mouth. Yeah, it's one of those things. Yeah.
I'm sophisticated too.
A little bit of trivia, the chocolate fondue was not invented until the 1960s, and it came out of New York. Swiss chef Conrad Egli at the Chalet Swiss restaurant came up with it. So it's not part of the tradition, which you think the folks that brought us Toblerone and all that other stuff would have come up with it. But I guess up in the mountains, it's the altitude. They didn't have that innovation.
Yeah, that is all over it. Strange. I mean, they're already melting things, and they're the, as you said, Toblerone and everything else is the home of chocolate.
I'm reminded of the conversation in, I think it's the Third Man movie with Orson Welles, where he says, Italy had centuries of discord and warfare, and they gave us the Renaissance, and Switzerland has had centuries of peace, and they gave us the cuckoo clock.
Yes.
and apparently they couldn't come up with chocolate fondue. So bless their hearts for the cheese fondue.
But they just didn't get the chocolate hot enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is another mention, switching gears suddenly.
Yes, please.
There is mention of a transponder in here. And
yes.
I was wondering where, I mean, I guess we're dealing with an alternate universe. We're dealing with Howard Stark. And his transponder idea, while, you know, it would have been available to, I mean, there was, you know, the understanding of where something is by range and distance has long been established back in the 30s. But the idea of carrying something with you that wasn't based on the tubes would indicate that Howard had some other form of amplification. I just don't know.
It's a good question that occurred to me, because Steve's device is, it's not iPhone size, but it's small enough to carry. And I would have had the exact same thought. How did you fit the vacuum tubes inside there, Howard?
Yeah, I don't think he would have been up on semiconductors in 43.
Yeah, and I don't know when like anything sort of portable like that would have come around, but you know, when you go back and you read air combat stories starting in World War II and then getting more prevalent after that, a lot of times you'll see references to IFF or identification friend or foe, and that refers to a transponder thing. And the transponder, we have them in just about any airplane that has an electrical system has a built-in transponder. And the it comes from sort of transmit and respond. And in a typical airplane, the transponder outside of a military application, the transponder is something that is equipped with a code. And you can be assigned a discrete code, or you can use sort of an overall category code. You're flying in just visual flight rules and not in anybody's airspace. Everybody's using 1200. You're just another bit of visual traffic out there. There are emergency codes for loss of communication, a general emergency, and hijacking. And if you do those, then those will light up people's radars. But the idea that you can sort of force it to send a proactive transmission. It's called doing an ident, which will make it sort of send a signal. But otherwise, it's a fairly passive thing, which vacuum tubes and semiconductors notwithstanding make sense in a situation like this, in that it's not going to broadcast until it's pinged, until a signal sort of reaches out to it and says, "Hey, what are you?" And then it would send a, send a code back or something. So
yeah,
an interesting choice, as opposed to just saying, here's your transmitter rather, or a beacon or something. Interesting choice to use a transponder.
Transponder. Yeah. I was thinking in terms of beacon, if I could conceive something that just sent out like a little radio signal, a little beep, beep, beep that maybe somebody could triangulate on. But transponders is a specific word that, probably somebody was writing the script thought sounded really cool.
Yeah, probably.
I'm looking up the history of U.S. Army Signal Corps field telephones, thinking along the same lines. And field telephones started appearing in some form or another as early as World War I. Now, they weren't radio-based, but the idea of the Army having something that could send a message a long distance, more or less electronically, is an old one.
Yeah, the handy talkie or the walkie talkie really changed the battlefield in terms of being able to report back on from forward positions where the bombs were landing, and being able to say you got to shorten it by another 300 yards or things like that. The communication aspect of battlefield operations really changed with the deployment of the walkie talkie in the early 40s, and all this stuff is along the nature of Armstrong working on high frequency and FM production, being able to get data back clearly from the front lines was quite a change. I mean, so many technological innovations popped up in World War II that changed the very nature of warfare. It's surprising that it didn't even change things more.
Right.
It doesn't strain my credulity that someone like, a genius like Howard Stark could come up with a, essentially like a long range walkie talkie of some sort. I wouldn't call that a transponder, but the idea that Steve could have some kind of electronic doodad on him that would let his friends know where he was. I buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's within range.
It's something that I wasn't aware of until I did a quick bit of reading along the side as well, is that when the British first started using the IFF, identification friend or foe version of the transponder that would, you know, send a signal in response to a radar inquiry. They called them the Parrot, and I had never come across that before.
Oh, neat.
But it makes a bit of sense.
One of the things that hit me as they were flying over the Italian Alps, here we are in 1943, and Italy's falling apart. I mean, Mussolini is about to give up the ghost, quite literally. And it's the end of Italy, and you just think about all the things they're flying over. He's talking about, where Stark is talking about flying to Lucerne for some fondue and stuff. And it's like, it points out that only, you know, not even a decade before, everything below them was a tourist paradise. It was the playground of the rich, being able to go skiing in the Alps and visiting Lucerne and going to places like Germany, which was the headquarters of European jazz and theater and things like that. And it's all lost because of the fanatical ideology of the Nazis and Hitler. And that always swings. I know, you guys are also big on alternate history and finding out what would have happened if not having a Hitler around or his cronies, what would have become of Europe. And I've been reading some historian ideas about what would have happened, and there's always the basic study in history is that either it's the great man hypothesis, where one man like a Hitler changes the world, or was the whole society involved in this, and if you didn't have Hitler, they would have had somebody like Hitler else. So I mean, you've got, you know, the after Versailles, you have all the resentment from the treaty, the great depression, hyperinflation, all the violence in the streets between the communists and nationalists, and the Weimar Republic had the emergency powers part in it in their constitution. So it's like the thing that I was getting out of it was the Weimar Republic was very fragile and likely to fail, but Hitler's role in it, Hitler seized the moment in finding that the people were ready for somebody to lead them out of it. And the two fields of thought is that they become very they're conservative, but not Nazi conservative. It's more like they join with the rest of Western Europe and become an opposition to Stalin. But then the rest of Europe is not ready to fight Stalin like they were ready to fight Hitler, and Stalin just kind of slowly creeps across Europe until you have this alternate Iron Curtain descending only earlier. You know, it would happen in the 30s or early 40s.
And probably more extensively, right? More
countries. Yeah, I would think it would, go through France easily, and then maybe, British would join them in some kind of a quiet revolution rather than an actual war.
Right. Yeah, you could easily see Britain at that time becoming sort of a lightweight socialist state, and certainly, showing some affinity toward an entirely Soviet Europe, but probably still maintaining, their own individual identity.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't have like the Nuremberg laws or Kristallnacht or the death camps, but the Jews of Poland and all the satellite, the what would become German satellites would wind up in the gulags anyway because of Stalin. So, maybe not a death camp in Poland, but a death camp somewhere in Siberia.
Well, it's interesting. I'm just musing now that if Stalin did, had in an alternative universe taken over Europe, we assume that he would have turned all of Europe into, vassals of the Soviet Union, and would have all been grim and Russian. But I wonder if they might have diluted it a little bit themselves just because of the weight of their history and culture. I mean, I just can't imagine France turning into East Germany. I wonder if... I just wonder if it would have been, as Hal just said, kind of a softer sort of Soviet communism.
Yeah, kind of like Yugoslavia kind of a thing. It's difficult. I mean, again, and the further you get away from the immediacy, it's hard to see where they would be from the 60s to the 80s. What the economy would be, and where, and also, you know, one of the things that World War II did as a side effect was break up colonialism. So a lot of the, you know, like the pummeling that Britain, France, Germany got during World War II loosened their grip on the rest of the rest of their colonies around the world. So I don't know if what the Commonwealth states would have been doing in, you know, in the 40s. And we're, you know, the big piece missing out of this is, what about Japan? Where does Japan fit in all this?
I think they would have been over there doing their own thing regardless, right?
Yeah, but
probably not allying with Stalin, for God's sake.
No,
and then there's the United States. I mean, the United States came out of World War II as you know, the superpower for a while, and began what has been called the American century. Do we have an American century if we don't have a Hitler in a World War II?
I don't think you do, because, you know, I think if it plays out like that, you know, whether it's Hitler or Stalin, you know, going all the way, if you look at, you know, Charles Lindbergh and the America Firsters things, if there was something that had happened that just said, you know what, we are just not going to get involved in this. And if, say, it was Stalin and these were sort of semi-bloodless revolutions and annexations and things, we wouldn't have had the appetite to go over and fight. We wouldn't have had the motivation, or maybe a lot of people wouldn't even seen a reason to. And if we're not in that fight, then we don't have that just absolutely unprecedented, and I would suggest never, not since repeated, pressure cooker of innovation and development of industry. You know, you think of every industry. I mean, I sit there and think, well, look at all the airplanes. We went from props to jets and all these things, but, you know, just weaponry, manufacturing techniques, materials, you know, fission and, you know, the nuclear sciences, just medicine, everything was just crushed together and grew like crazy.
I swear to God, Hal, I thought you just said fishing, like lures.
Oh,
and
fishing. Yes. Yes.
And, I mean, fishing.
Salmon,
yes.
Salmon production increased massively. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Smarty Pants, you look at a fly that was tied in 1939, and then you look at
totally
tied
different.
In 1946.
Different
you,
product.
Yeah,
the
you
technology
tell me you
is amazing.
Tell
yeah.
Apart. The Teflon and little bits of nylon.
Velcro. Yeah.
Yeah. Velcro. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you think about it. You don't fishing. Have you don't have Operation Paperclip, so you don't have the space program. So
right,
we might
right.
not even be
yeah.
on the moon.
Yeah.
But right. the other side of it, let's say you don't have Hitler to contend with. You have Stalin and like an early Cold War, but you still have, if you still have Pearl Harbor, everybody in the ETO gets to fight, as well as the Pacific Theater people get to fight Japan. So it might be, you know, a shorter war, and a conventional war, and a very bloody one. I'm not sure.
And that's a good question, is if you know, without Europe being, and again, assuming that whatever this sort of hypothetical revolution is happens, that it's fairly bloodless. And I don't know when you're thinking it would have been done, but, you know, say it was done by like 36, 37, so even a bit on the early side, you know, are the Japanese going to move on Pearl Harbor, without the distraction of everything else that's going on in Europe? If Europe is under this new Iron Curtain, but at least sort of quiet and stable, I think the Japanese are moving and expanding, but are they going to come and attack, you know, a currently sort of neutral nation that has at least reasonable armed forces and industrial capacity?
Probably no reason to, if they're just marching through China at will, you know.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then you do wonder, okay, what happens between Japan and the Soviets? Do they, you know, is, you know, are they the superpowers at that point?
Yeah. Thank God we had Captain America.
Yeah.
Yes. What a relief. How close we came to all of these horrible things.
Wow. Yeah, this is anyway. This is a whole. You could have a whole podcast about what if things, but actually, Marvel could even have a whole comic series based on
and an anime. Yeah, an animated series about what if.
Wow.
Let's get Feige on the horn.
Let's pitch that.
Yeah. Well, we'll discuss it with Haley Atwell on some future episode.
Yes, Haley, you still owe us a phone call. I'm waiting.
We're waiting for you, Captain Carter.
Someday. She hasn't said no yet, so we're very, you know.
That's right.
Remain optimistic.
And again, back to the mist. You bring up Haley. She just, her acting in this minute is great when she just first kind of shuts down Howard and his flirtation, and then just kind of shuts down Steve and his idiocy, and without a word. She doesn't say a word to either of them. Just let's get back to business, gentlemen. And it's a nice bit of acting doing absolutely nothing.
Right.
Yeah. If you had to read her mind, the only thing you'd hear is men.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Although for both, I thought it was nice though, because and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I thought that when she's telling Steve, you know, he's the best civilian pilot, he's the only one who's mad enough to do this, we're lucky to have him, I get the tiniest sense that that's a little bit of reassurance for Steve. Like,
oh yeah,
don't worry. You know, that's not what this is, and things. And then, you know, you're waiting for, you know, I wish we'd pan around and find that Basil Exposition is in the back of the airplane and just saying, it's just a pot full of melted cheese. It's okay. Just relax, Steve.
And you should do likewise. Wow. Well, this has been a very thorough and I mean, it's interesting how far afield we can go on these minutes, but I think we learned a lot about fondue and a lot about the alternate universe of what might have been. Lots more to come. And I really would like to hear what the audience would think of some of these theories and what their fondue experiences are. Hopefully they haven't turned the page of listening to how the Fees family dips into the communal pot. But we'll find out.
That might have grossed them all out, you think, maybe?
It's possible. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you sold a lot of Gruyere today, but we'll see. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. And please check out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.